I mentioned yesterday that I have four rabbi stories that come from Poland, so I'll work through those four, starting with one right now. As you may know, there are Jewish communities all around the world, and Jewish communities have a reputation for being intelligent. And this is true. But there's one exception, and that is there's a town in Poland called Chelm, spelled C-H-E-L-M. C-H-E-L-M. Before the Second World War, had a very large Jewish community. I got to speak there about a year ago. The Jews of Chelm were not famous for being particularly intelligent. And while Jews elsewhere in the world learned to think logically through their Talmudic studies, the Jews of Chelm would think logically by telling each other riddles. So what is a wise man of Chelm? A wise man of Chelm is someone who could tell riddles no one else could solve. Any riddle brought to him, he could solve it. And the most famous riddle maker and teller in Chelm happened to be the rabbi of Chelm. He could tell riddles nobody else could solve, and anytime they brought him a riddle, he could solve it. He had this great desire to visit New York City. It was a time in the Jewish history when there are far more Jews in New York City alone than all of Israel. And all the famous rabbis, all the famous rabbinic schools were all in New York City. And so he had this great desire to visit the city. The Jewish community in Chelm raised enough money for him to take a one-month trip to New York. When he lands at New York Airport, he is picked up by a New York taxi driver assigned to take him to the Jewish community. And it's about an hour and a half drive from the airport, and they begin a conversation. New York taxi driver asked the rabbi, "Would you like to hear a riddle?" Rabbi says, "Do I want to hear a riddle? Where I come from, we tell each other riddles all day long. And I'm the most famous riddle solver in my community. So you tell me your riddle, I bet I can solve it." New York taxi driver says, "All right, here's the riddle. My parents had a child. The child was not my brother nor my sister. Could this child be?" And the rabbi started thinking about it, how to solve it and solve it. He's getting closer, he has to leave the taxi. So he says, "I'm usually very good at this, but this is a hard one. I have to give up. Who was this child your parents had that was not your brother, not your sister?" New York taxi driver says, "The answer is me. I'm the child my parents had, and not my brother, not my sister." Rabbi says, "What a wonderful riddle. I can't wait to get home and tell my people this riddle. They will love this riddle." So after a great month, he flies back, and even the Jews who did not attend synagogue regularly all came out on the first Sabbath after his return to find out about his adventures. They want to know what rabbis he met, what schools he visited. He got up behind the podium and he said, "I will give you a day-by-day account. But first, when I was in America, I heard this tremendous riddle. Would you like to hear it first?" "Oh, yes," they said, "we haven't heard a good one since you left us a month ago." Rabbi says, "All right, here's the riddle. My parents had a child. He was not my brother nor my sister. Who could this child be?" And all this noise broke out in synagogue as we were trying to solve it. After a while, things got quieter and quieter, and finally dead silence. And finally, a spokesman said, "Rabbi, we tried to figure this one out by ourselves, but we couldn't do so. So who was this child your parents had that was not your brother, not your sister?" The rabbi says, "It was a New York taxi driver I met in America." Now we come to chapter 14. What happens in chapter 14, after describing the work of the counterfeit Trinity in chapters 12 and 13, are seven mid-tribulational announcements based upon what is now happening and what they're going to face in the quick future. And that chart you're looking at is still the same one from last night, the events of the middle of the tribulation. And there are specific purposes for these mid-trib announcements. First of all, to predict the failure of the program of the counterfeit Trinity. And the program of the counterfeit Trinity is to try to annihilate all the Jews to avoid the second coming. And these seven proclamations is to show that that program is going to fail. Secondly, to announce the results of the bowl judgments, which will be the worst series of judgments comprising chapters 15 and 16. And then thirdly, to give words of assurance, encouragement, and comfort to the saints living in the second half of the tribulation. As severe as it was for the saints of the first half, those of the second half are going to suffer more severely, because with the Marcus 666 identifying those who follow the Antichrist and those who do not, it becomes apparent right away who is a follower and who isn't. And those who choose not to take the mark are targeted for destruction. The first proclamation is in chapter 14, verses 1 through 5, a proclamation concerning the 144,000 Jews. And in verse 1, notice it's a millennial scene. And in verse 1, the Messiah is in the Messianic kingdom on Mount Zion, and with him are the 144,000 Jews with him. And the fact that these 144,000 Jews survived the tribulation and they are with the Messiah in the kingdom will show that Satan's program of total Jewish destruction will fail. Because if the 144,000 survive, so many other Jews survive as well. So in verses 2 and 3, he describes the song that they will be singing. It's a song only they will know. In verses 4 and 5, we learn some more things about the 144,000 chapter 7 did not tell us. First of all, these 144,000 virgins, male virgins, because the condition in the tribulation would not be conducive to marriage and family. And they will follow Messiah continually. It was referred to as the first fruits. And the term first fruits is always the first of more to come later. Like the Feast of First Fruits, that's just the first of more to come later. And the more to come later will be the Jewish individuals that will be saved throughout the tribulation, and especially as more significant is that the whole nation will come to faith at the end of the tribulation. As we'll see, it will happen the last 3 days of the tribulation. He describes them as being without a lie, so they have no internal defilement, without blemish, no external defilement. And this select group that was God used to evangelize the world in the first half of the tribulation are going to be the ones that will be prominent in the Messianic kingdom. The second proclamation is in chapter 14, verses 6 and 7. It's a final call to the whole world to accept the gospel message and to make the final choice between Messiah or the Antichrist. Keep in mind what we saw yesterday. At this point, the word goes out to the whole world. They need to worship the Antichrist and to show their acceptance of him as God by taking the mark of 666. And so this angelic voice is going to fly in the atmospheric heavens, and this angelic voice is going to be proclaiming the gospel to everybody in the world in the language that they speak. Now, the third proclamation deals with the fall of political Babylon, and this will be detailed in chapter 18, which we'll get to later today. The fourth proclamation is in verses 9 through 12. And now he's warning everybody as they're making their choices to take the mark or not to take the mark. And he points out that taking the mark, they reach the point of no return. To take the mark is to reach the point of no return. And once they've taken the mark, they'll have no opportunity to be saved thereafter. That's the same point Paul makes in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verses 8 through 12. And again, 2 Thessalonians 2, 8 through 12 is sometimes used to try to teach If you hear the gospel before the rapture, you will not be able to be saved after the rapture. However, the rapture is not discussed in that passage. What is discussed is the abomination of desolation, which happens at the midpoint. As we mentioned in chapter 13, you have the death and resurrection of the Antichrist, and then using that as evidence of his deity. And so those who choose to take the mark would not do it out of ignorance. That's the point of verses 8 through 12 of 2 Thess. Because they rejected the word of the truth, they are now deceived by the counterfeit signs and wonders. Because they rejected the message of truth that they did hear, that rejection now leaves them open to deception because of the counterfeit miracles and signs and wonders. And they'll be destined for two things. First of all, they will drink of the wine of the wrath of God, and the wine of the wrath of God is the bowl judgments of chapters 15 and 16. And secondly, they'll be destined to the lake of fire. Now keep in mind, nobody will take the mark of the beast out of ignorance, because everybody will hear the gospel at least two times, if not more. They will hear it from the 144,000 Jews, but secondly, they will hear it from the of the angel flying at the atmosphere, giving the gospel to people all over the world in the language in which they speak. So everybody will hear the message at least two times. So when they choose to take the mark, it's not out of ignorance. It's out of the rejection of the gospel message that they heard at least twice. So keep in mind, biblically, the point of return is not having heard the gospel before the rapture and can't believe afterwards. The point of return is when they take the mark. Now, as a word of comfort to the saints of that day, this is the patience of the saints, because that they will learn very quickly that the people who are now believers are being killed, massacred, martyred throughout the second half in a far more severe pattern that was happening in the first half. And these people who are suffering the persecution can realize if they're caught and they're executed, in 3.5 years or less, they'll be resurrected. And while those who are doing the killing, those who have the mark, won't be able to get saved, and they're destined initially for hell, ultimately for the lake of fire. You have the fifth proclamation, which is a word of encouragement to saints who die in the second half of the tribulation, and therefore there's a special blessing is promised to them. The sixth proclamation is in verses 14 through 16, a proclamation of reaping. A reaping is a common symbol of salvation. And that points out, in spite of so much emphasis against people coming to faith, in the second half, nevertheless, many people will still come to faith. And coming to faith only for those who have not taken the mark. So in spite of such massive social disturbances against anything to believe in, many will come to a saving knowledge of Yeshua the Messiah. But the seventh proclamation is a proclamation of threshing, and that's a common symbol of judgment. And what he sees in this seventh proclamation is the treading of the grapes. And these grapes, notice, are gathered together for what? For suffering the wrath of God. And again, the wrath of God is going to be the bowl judgments. He describes the worst of it as being outside the city, that would be Jerusalem. Or it's outside the city, is the Valley of Kidron. The Valley of Kidron begins just north of the city wall. Actually, it runs the whole length of the desert into the Dead Sea. But the section of the Kidron Valley that parallels the city wall and the Mount of Olives, that section alone is called the Valley of Jehoshaphat, the valley where the judgment occurs. And we shall see that ends up being the final stage of the campaign of Armageddon. And blood will, when the campaign of Armageddon comes to a close, blood will flow from there for a distance of four feet in height, and will go all the way to flow for 200 miles. As we come to the campaign of Armageddon later today, we'll see how this fits. So these were the seven proclamations made in the midrib, warning people of what's happening at this point of time, encouraging them to make the right decision, though it could mean they would not survive physically, and warning them of the very near future, the wrath of God of the bold judgments and the war Armageddon. So now we come to chapter 15, which is the second half, and in your charts, you now want to turn on chart number 6 on page 6, and this is the second half of the tribulation. The second half of the tribulation. Now, the end of chapter 11. We pointed out the last verse of chapter 11 is the cataclysmic events in heaven in preparation for the third series of judgment, but then he dropped it. In chapters 12, 13, and 14, following that law recurrence we talked about in the first session, just goes back to earlier segments of the book of Revelation to add much more details, which is what we have finished covering as of this moment. So where the last verse of chapter 11 left off, involving events in heaven, especially the temple of God in heaven, this is now picked up in chapter 15, verse 1 through chapter 16, verse 1, elaborates on the prelude in heaven before the outpouring of the bold judgments. So verse 1, we're told about the seven angels. To them is going to be given the seven bold judgments. And notice what he says here, this will complete the wrath of God, which is what he said about the seventh trumpet back in chapter 10 and 11. Now the seven trumpets will complete the wrath of God. Now he says the same thing about the bold judgments. Again, that shows that just as the seventh seal contained the seven trumpet judgments, by the same token, the seventh trumpet will contain the seven bowl judgments, and that will complete the wrath of God. Verses 2 through 4 focuses on the martyred saints of the second half of the tribulation, pointing out they conquered in the spiritual warfare. They refused to take the mark of the beast, which was the cause of their martyrdom. And so they sing two songs in verse 3 and 4. The first song they sing is the song of Moses. Moses gave us two songs. The first one is in Exodus chapter 15, verses 1 through 8. The second one is the book of Deuteronomy, chapter 32. So the song of Moses might refer either to Exodus 15, Deuteronomy chapter 32, we don't know which, but then, by the way, both songs are songs of victory, so in the end, the theme is the same. And then they will sing the song of the Lamb in verse 3 and 4, and the song of the Lamb is given to us right in these verses. And then in verse, you have the preparation for the pouring out of the seven bowls in verses 5 through 8. In the verses 5 and 6, notice the seven angels come forward. And then in verse 7, the seven angels are given the seven bowls. And as we saw the activity of Shekinah glory at the last verse of chapter 11, here's where it picks it up. And notice the same focus, the Shekinah glory in the heavenly temple in verse 8. So again, just picking up from where the last verse of chapter 11 left off. Is all in preparation for the outpouring of the bowl judgments. And finally, chapter 16, verse 1, you have the command for the bowl judgments to begin. So that was this, from chapter 15, verse 1 to chapter 16, verse 1 was all was the prelude in heaven, the longer one than what we saw previously. Now in chapter 16, verses 2 through 21, we have the outpouring of the bowl judgments. And because the events of the midpoint of tribulation begin the midpoint and continue in the second half, these seven bowl judgments actually occur more towards the latter part of the second half of the tribulation, more towards the latter part in fairly quick succession. And the first bowl judgments are the ulcers that break upon the skin. These are ulcers, cancerous ulcers. But it fulfills what he said back in chapter 14, verses 9 through 11, that the bowl judgments are going to be focusing on those who take the mark. The bowl judgments will be targeting those who take the mark. And this is seen that this is limited to those who have taken the mark. And it's not, wouldn't be unusual if the cancerous ulcers actually break out on that part of the body where the mark was taken, the right hand or the forehead. Then comes the second bowl judgments in verse 3. Now, in the second trumpet judgment, it destroyed one-third of the earth's salt waters by turning into blood. And now in the second bowl judgment, the rest of the salt waters are going to turn into blood. So it destroys the remainder of all sea life. These are far more severe judgments. The third bowl judgments in verses 4 through 7 will destroy the fresh water supply. Now in the third trumpet judgment, you'll recall, one-third of all the world's fresh water supply is destroyed. But now fresh water, as far as rivers and springs, are turned into blood in verse 4. And in verses 5 and 6, you have the declaration of the God angel of the waters declaring God's righteousness in this kind of judgment. And in verse 7, the altar also declares God's righteousness in rendering judgment upon humanity for their sins. Apparently, water in wells and cisterns will survive. Now, the fourth bowl judgment is in verses 8 and 9. In the fourth trumpet judgment is when the one-third of the light of the sun and one-third of the light of the moon, the stars, was either destroyed or simply turned into darkness. And the fourth bowl judgment also affects the heavenlies, but this time the sun specifically and the temperature of the sun will be increased. And the temperature shall be increased specifically by divine judgment, not by people using deodorant too often and causing the rise of the heat. But God said will increase the sun tremendously, and people will be scourged. They'll blaspheme God, and as they have done in previous judgments in verse 9, they simply refuse to repent. And with those who have the mark, they don't have the capacity to repent anymore. The fifth bowl judgment is in verses 10 and 11. And here we have the fourth of the five blackouts. And once again, no sun comes to the earth from the sun, moon, and stars. But notice he specifies it falls upon the kingdom of the beast. If you go back to the 10 plagues that fell upon Egypt, one of these 10 plagues was the plague of darkness, and the whole land of Egypt was put into blackness and darkness except one area, the area of Goshen in Egypt, which is where the Jews were living. So notice he focuses on this judgment that the darkness would cover the kingdom of the beast, which includes the whole world, except once. Well, three ancient countries, Moab, Ammon, and Edom, which today is the land of Jordan. We haven't gotten this yet, but we will, because that is what the Jews are fleeing to since the midpoint of the tribulation. The Jews are fleeing to, they'll be like there, that's outside the kingdom of the beast. And furthermore, just as the darkness was a darkness that also caused pain upon the Egyptians in the 10 plagues, same thing happens here. They'll suffer a gnawing pain because of this darkness. But in verse 11, their response is to simply continue to blaspheme God. Now we come to the beginnings of the campaign of Armageddon. So turn to your chart number 7. Which will give you the map I'll be giving you on the screen. We'll now deal with some more detail, the bowl judgments, the fifth and the sixth and seventh bowl judgments. Now, the beginning of the campaign of Armageddon starts with the sixth bowl judgment, and then the conclusion, the eighth stage, is with the seventh bowl judgment. So everything else about the Armageddon is found elsewhere in Scripture. Revelation deals with the starting point and the ending point. So this is the map you have in your hand. Probably be easier to read what's in your hand. But we're going to deal with this stage by stage. So verses 12 to 16 of Revelation 16 gives us the first stage of the campaign of Armageddon. And we should note that what happens is that at this point of time, the Euphrates River is dried up to make it easier for the king, for the army to move. And the city of Babylon, which is now the capital, economic and political capital of the world, sits on the banks of the Euphrates River. And notice that it's in this verse that he mentions the kings of the east at the end of verse 16, at the end of verse 12. And so at this point, he mentions the kings of the east. Notice the kings of the east are now leading an army of 200 million. That was chapter 9, and that was really a demonic invasion. Here you have a human invasion. But again, the East is not the Far East in biblical parlance. It's always the Near East and the regions of Mesopotamia. And so when the Messiah was born, you had wise men from the East. The East is where they came from, which is Mesopotamia, not the Far East. So the East here should be kept in its normal biblical usage in the Near East, Mesopotamian region. And so the Euphrates River is now dried up, make it easier for the armies of the Antichrist to move. And the verses 13 and 14 describe a decree. And the issuing of this decree is from Babylon on the Euphrates to all of the kings that have been under the Antichrist authority since the midpoint of tribulation, since the previous 3.5 years. And the person, and notice he clearly points out that this issuing of this decree for armies together is the work of the counterfeit Trinity. And he says in verse 13, out of the mouth of the dragon, the counterfeit father, out of the mouth of the beast, the counterfeit son, out of the mouth of the false prophet, the counterfeit Holy Spirit. And then, not only is it the work of the counterfeit Trinity, but demons go out with this decree to make sure that these other kings fall into line. Now, this last conflict has frequently been called historically the Battle of Armageddon, which is a bit of a misnomer because it won't be just one battle. So most Bar prophecy teachers that take the Bible literally have been using the campaign of Armageddon as we've been using, but that too is technically a misnomer. Because insofar as the Bible itself is concerned, there'll be no fighting in the valley itself. That's where the armies gather together, but the fighting will occur elsewhere. And as an analogy, we'll play a similar role that England played in the closing stages of the Second World War, where the Allied forces gathered together in Britain, but the final campaign began on the beaches of Normandy in France on D-Day. And what England was to World War II, Armageddon will be in this final conflict, a place where the armies gather, but the fighting will occur elsewhere. There's a biblical name for this conflict, and that's found in the verse 14. Notice the war of the great day of God the Almighty. That's the third world war of the tribulation, the war of the great day of God, the Almighty. And this is your biblical name for the war. In verse 15, there's a parenthetical statement addressing to the saints living at this point of time. That when they hear of this decree calling all of the armies together into this specific locality, they are to receive a message of comfort to the saints living at this point of time. Because when they hear of this decree, that will be a sign of the soon coming of the second coming. Because within the eight stages of the campaign of Armageddon will be the second coming of the Messiah. And so the decree to gather marks the soon return of the Messiah, and this will be an encouraging sign that will provide them some comfort. And finally, in verse 16, we're told what the place of the gathering is. And the place of the gathering is called, he says, it's called in Hebrew, Har Megiddon. Literally, it means the mountain of Megiddo. Now, Christians have come to call this large valley the Valley of Armageddon, but it's never called that in Scripture. The biblical name for the valley is the Valley of Jezreel. The Valley of Jezreel. So you see in your Bible, the Valley of Jezreel, that's what Christians have come to call the Valley of Armageddon. It's the largest of Israel's valleys, the most productive of all the lands of Israel. But again, as far as the text is concerned, there'll be no fighting in this valley. It'll just be a place of gathering. Now, we're going to have to make use of other passages before we continue with Revelation. So let me point out there are two other passages that deal with this. For your notes, you can mark down Psalm 2, the second psalm, but we'll look up the second minor prophet, Joel chapter 2. Joel chapter 2, second minor prophet, not 2, but Joel chapter 3. Joel chapter 3. Now let's switch those five messages. Look at the one for Armageddon. This will provide pictures of the area that'll give you a better view of what's happening. Okay, Joel chapter 3. Look at verse 9. Proclaim ye this among the nations, be pure war, stir up the mighty men, let all the men of war draw near, let them come up. Beat your plowshares into swords, your pruning hooks into spears, let the weak say, I am strong, haste ye and come, all ye nations round about, and gather yourselves together. Thither cause your mighty ones to come down, O Jehovah. Now God's viewpoint of these armies coming together is a viewpoint of mockery. The Revelation passage gave us the human perspective, where the emperor of the world calls his allied kings to bring their armies together and meet him in the Jezreel Valley. But the emphasis of this passage is one of mockery. It's stronger in the second psalm. Psalm 2 says, as the Lord watches these nations come against him and his anointed one, or his Messiah, he says, the one who sits in the heavens will laugh, and the Lord will have the nations in derision. So while in Revelation, while in Joel, he's mocking them, in Psalm 2, he's laughing at them. In the mockery, it says, go ahead and gather yourselves together. Go ahead and turn your farming equipment into weapons of war, and those who are weakened and cowardly, deceive yourselves to pretend you're strong and courageous. Because while Satan has his purpose to gather these armies together, destroy the Jewish people still living at this point of time, God has his own purpose for allowing them to come together. It'll be God's purpose that will be fulfilled. Because then we can cut the lights down a bit. Hopefully this will be give you a better view. Now, the valley you're looking at is the Jezreel Valley. And I'm standing on Mount Megiddo. I'm standing on the west side of the valley, standing in Armageddon, the mountain of Megiddo, looking towards the northeast. And the northern border of these range of these hills, and these are the hills of Nazareth. And the city of Nazareth, where Jesus grew up, is located in those hills. Next. Next. You see, the eastern border is marked by two things. You have the dome-shaped mountain called Mount Tabor, T-A-B-O-R, and the pointy mount, which is called the Hill of Moreh, M-O-R-E-H, M-O-R-E-H. And these two mark the eastern boundary of the Jezreel Valley. Next. Here's a closer view of Mount Tabor. Mount Tabor is the traditional Catholic site of the Transfiguration. And in the account we're given in Scripture, you will notice that when the apostles saw Jesus transfigured, Peter piped up and says, let me build three tabernacles, one for you, one for Moses, one for Elijah. Well, Peter was not allowed to build those three tabernacles. However, he did not have to worry. The Catholic Church has proceeded to build all three tabernacles for Peter. You can barely see the building up here. Slight building right here. And that originally was three separate buildings, small structures. In the early 20th century, it was unified under one large Catholic church, is what you'll see when you go up there today. The trouble is they picked the wrong mountain. And the real transfiguration occurred 45 miles northeast of this mountain on Mount Hermon, not on Mount Tabor. And so they missed this by 45 miles. But they've done worse. Next. Now here's a section of Tabor, which is the eastern point. Here's the closer view of the Hill of Moreh. And the Hill of Moreh is a twofold witness to God's power of resurrection. Because here on the southern slopes of the hill is the town of Shunem, and that's where Elisha raised a woman's son back to life. And here on the northern slopes is the town of Nain or Naim, and that's where Jesus raised a woman's son back to life. And so this is a twofold witness to God's power of resurrection. Next. Now we're looking southeast. Here's a section of the hill of Moreh, but the southern border is marked by two things, Mount Gilboa and the hill and the hills of Samaria. This is a small section of Mount Gilboa. Next. Here's a closer view of just part of the Mount Gilboa range. And Mount Gilboa is where Saul and three of his sons were killed by the Philistines, and that set the stage for the establishment of the kingdom of David. Next. Oh, this I can move it. Sorry, I'll move it. Now, on the horizon, what you see here are the hills of Samaria, which with Mount Gilboa mark the southern border of the Israel Valley. All these pictures you've seen so far are from the west side of the valley. Now, we're going to cross over to the east side of the valley. I am now standing on Mount Tabor, on the east side, looking west. On the right-hand side, you again see the hills of Nazareth, where Jesus grew up. Here in the distance, in the haze, is another range of mountain called Mount Carmel, and Mount Carmel marks the western border of the Jezreel Valley. Here's a closer view, just part of the Mount Carmel range. What you see here is the River Kishon, K-I-S-H-O-N, K-I-S-H-O-N. Now, Mount Carmel is where Elijah had this contest with the prophets of Baal. And when they lost the contest, they were all taken down to this river and they were executed by the river. And the river goes as a continuous flowing beyond our slide. Goes right close to the Mount Carmel, and that's about where the slaughter would have taken place. Now here is what Armageddon means. It's not the name for the whole valley, but Armageddon or Har Magedon is city, means the mountain of Megiddo, and that's the Tel Megiddo, the mountain of Megiddo, and that's where the city of Megiddo once sat. And this will be the point where the Antichrist will meet with the seven allied kings. Though obviously the armies will be spread out in the valley itself, and this is the first stage of the Armageddon campaign. Now for the second stage, turn to Isaiah chapter 13. There are five lengthy chapters, all describing the second stage. And these five chapters are Isaiah chapters 13 and 14, Isaiah 13 and 14, and Jeremiah chapter 50 and 51, Jeremiah 50, 51, and Revelation 18. We'll deal with Revelation 18 as we come to it later, but we're going to focus on certain segments of Isaiah and Jeremiah only. And Jeremiah 13, verse 1. The burden of Babylon, which Isaiah the son of Amos did see, set up an ensign upon the bare mountain, lift up the voice unto them, wave the hand, they may go into the gates of the nobles. I have commanded my consecrated ones, yea, I have called my mighty men for mine anger, even my proudly exulting ones. The noise of a multitude in the mountains is as of a great people, the noise of the multitude of the kingdoms of the nations gathered together. Jehovah hosts is mustering the host for the battle. They come from a far country of the uttermost parts of heaven, even Jehovah and the weapons of his indignation to destroy the whole land. And what we Isaiah is describing is what armies gathering together, but these are anti-Babylon armies or anti-Antichrist armies. And these are gathering for the express purpose of destroying the city of Babylon. And you look at the details of the destruction of Babylon in here in Jeremiah, later in Revelation 18, that has never been fulfilled. Remember, Medo-Persia conquered Babylon, but the city of Babylon remained intact. And the events of chapter 6 of Daniel take place in the city of Babylon after Persia took it over. And furthermore, here in chapter 13, verse 6 and verse 12, verse 6 and verse 12, he gives the timing of the element. And the timing is 6 and verse 9, I should say. Verse 6 and verse 9, the timing element is the day of the Lord, the day of Jehovah. And again, that's the most common biblical name for the tribulation. It's always viewed as a time of special divine judgment. It's also in preparation for the establishment of the kingdom, which happens in chapter 14, verses 1 and 2. So this is not an event that occurred any time in ancient history. It's something that will yet occur in the future during the day of Jehovah. Another thing to notice in verse 3, the ones who are destroying Babylon are his consecrated ones, his holy ones, his sainted ones. Just kind of keep that in mind. We'll come back to that momentarily. But details continue in chapter 14 down to verse 23. Let's go to the book of Jeremiah, chapter 50. Jeremiah, chapter 50. Let's begin with verse 9, chapter 50, verse 9. For lo, I will stir up and cause to come up against Babylon a company of great nations from the north country. They shall set themselves in array against her. From thence she shall be taken. Their arrow shall be of an expert mighty man. None shall return in vain. And Chaldea shall be a prey. And all that prey upon her shall be satisfied, says Jehovah. Now skip over to chapter 50, verse 41. Behold, the people come from the north, and a great nation, and many kings shall be stirred up from the uttermost parts of the earth, and they lay hold on bow and spear. They are cruel and have no mercy. Their voice roars like the sea, and they ride upon horses, every one set in array against you, O daughter of Babylon. What Jeremiah describes is what Isaiah described more than a century and a half earlier. Groups of armies are gathering, but they're coming for the express purpose of destroying the city of Babylon. As we shall see later in Revelation chapter 18, when they destroy Babylon, it'll be done suddenly, quickly, and massively. And before anybody knows what's happening, Babylon, the capital of the world, is burning and burning away. Now, what's important about Jeremiah's prophecy is that he clearly indicates that the king of Babylon is not within the city when these events occur. For example, verse 43, the king of Babylon had heard the tidings of them, his hands waxed feeble, anguish has taken hold of him, and pangs as of a woman in travail. Now, skip over to chapter 51 and verse 31. 51:31. One post shall run to meet another, one messenger to meet another, to show the king of Babylon the city is taken every quarter, the passages are seized, the reeds are burned with fire, and the men of war are frightened. The fact that messengers must be sent out to inform the king of Babylon that the city has been destroyed by fire is the clear indication not within the city when these events occur. If he's not within the city, where then would he be? And by comparing the passages of the first stage with these of the second, as the Antichrist has left the city and removed his own army out of the city, the enemies of the Antichrist, the consecrated ones, these would be Gentile believers of that day that didn't follow the party line, will take the opportunity to quickly and suddenly destroy his city. So Isaiah 13, verses 1 through 5, there's an international revolt against Babylon. Another gathering, anti-Babylon or anti-Antichrist forces for the purpose of destroying Babylon, done by God's consecrated ones. And the details, Isaiah 13, verse 6 to chapter 14, verse 23. Again, the timing will be the day of Jehovah in chapter 13, verse 6 and 7, verse 6 and verse 9. In Jeremiah 50, verses 9 and 10, verses 41 and 42, Jeremiah sees what Isaiah saw, groups of armies gathering for the purpose of destroying Babylon, the capital of the world under the Antichrist. What happened here? And Revelation 18, we'll get to later on, so I'm not going to cover it just here. Now, these two passages in Jeremiah shows the king of Babylon is absent from a city. His hearing of Babylon's destruction and his reaction, and messengers have to be sent to him in a relay situation, runner to runner, to inform him that the city has been destroyed. So putting these two passages, to these first two stages together, while he's in the valley of Jezreel, away from the city, he's taking his army out of the city, his enemies take the opportunity to gather and then destroy the city of Babylon. There's the map of it. So while the Antichrist is meeting his own forces in the northern part of Israel, over here, Babylon is over here, the enemies come and destroy the city. Normally, like with the other stages that you saw, we'll see, I would have a series of slides showing you where Babylon has been rebuilt. In fact, Saddam Hussein did rebuild the city before he was deposed by President Bush. You can say he was bushwhacked. They may not be good, but they are original. But the city has been largely rebuilt. I don't have pictures for you of this, because notice where Babylon sits. Where Babylon sits today is within the Arab country of Iraq, inside the green borderline. Boy. And the Arab country of Iraq does not like 5'4" Jewish kids running around the country taking pictures of it. So I don't happen to have those pictures for you just yet. But maybe after the next Arab-Israeli war, I can get those for you.